This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ever wonder what's up there on the red planet? Alan Howard has been pursuing that question for close to 40 years. Funny story how it gets started, and we'll get to that. But fact is, his research pretty conclusively shows that there once had to have been water on Mars, meaning it's possible there once could have been life there. Dr. Howard's a geomorphologist, and we'll explain that too, but since when it comes to looking into space, astronomy is what we usually think of, we've also invited a couple of scientists from that field to share some of what they've been finding. One hint, they too have long been fascinated by the possibility of life out there. Mars, our primary focus this hour, but places like Titan, Europa, even Enceladus are likely to come up. So hold on, lift off ahead, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Is there now, or has there ever been, life on Mars? What, in your mind, would it take to answer that question to your satisfaction? If you have an answer, insight to share, or questions of your own, either about the red planet specifically, or planetary exploration in general, please do call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Later in the program, we're going to meet up with two astronomers who are doing some fascinating work on space, but we begin with a man who essentially is a very specific kind of geologist and who is one of the pioneers of research determining the conditions on the planet Mars at least one time were such that life could have existed there. He is a professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia, Dr. Alan Howard. Thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Howard, is there now or was there ever life on Mars?
Well, that's the billion-dollar question, literally as well, because we're spending a lot of resources sending missions to Mars to try to answer that question. If we knew the answer, we wouldn't send missions there, probably. We had early in Mars history, for about the first third of the 4.5 billion years that Mars has been present. In fact, that's the same age as essentially all the planets in our solar system. Mars had an environment that had flowing water on the surface, lakes, possibly oceans. That's when Mars might have developed some sort of life, probably just unicellular organisms, that is, sort of like bacteria and the like. But then, roughly about 1 billion years into its history, the magnetic field on Mars shut down because our magnetic field is generated by convection currents in our liquid core, which is iron and nickel, that creates a magnetic field. Well, that doesn't sound like it has much to do with life, but it does, because what that magnetic field does on Earth is it protects our atmosphere from being attacked by radiation coming from the sun that drives off molecules into space. Well, Mars used to have such a magnetic field, but it shut down. And
Do we know why it shut down?
Mars is smaller than Earth, and basically it lost its heat energy earlier on, and so that it also has a core, but it just cooled and solidified, and that shut down the magnetic field.
So lose your magnetic field, lose your atmosphere?
And you lose, as a consequence of that, the radiation from the sun can, not immediately, but over a period of time, pick up and strip off many of the gases that are in the atmosphere. And so that at the present time, Mars' atmosphere is only about 1/100 that of that we see on Earth in terms of the pressure.
So this devastation to Mars' atmosphere, scientists like yourself think that that happened about 3.5 billion years ago?
A little earlier than that, but the presence of water continued for a while until the atmosphere got stripped away. So it was maybe a little after 4 billion years that before the present, that the magnetic field shut down.
So the conventional wisdom, Alan Howard, is that, at least among scientists, that Earth and Mars and the rest of our solar system has been around for about 4.5 billion years?
That's true.
And so for the first half a billion, for the first 500 million years, you and others in your field are pretty certain that Mars had a pretty solid atmosphere and plenty of water.
Yes. There are various clues to that, like there are systems of river channels, what used to be river channels that have been carved into the surface of Mars, evidence that there was standing water and a deposition of materials that were carried by these rivers into the lakes and deposited to forming layers, like we see layers of sediment in our oceans. So we can see those features. They've long been inactive, but their trace on the surface is still there.
Alan, it's my understanding that there's just a fascinating series of coincidences for how this became your field or one of your fields for which you have won so many awards and so much recognition from your peers. But first of all, I need to ask, you are a geomorphologist.
Yeah, literally the term means the shape of the Earth. But it concerns not only how the surface looks like, but how it got that way. The kinds
so
of things like...
So basically how landscapes get formed.
Yes, by rainfall, by glaciers, by wave action, whatever. That's the field of geomorphology.
And it's a very specific field of geology? Is that a fair...
Yeah, it's a subset. There are people that, for example, look at how igneous rocks form well beneath the surface. So that's not part of the type of geology that I do. There are people that look at how the internal forces of Earth compress and deform rocks. And so there's a whole set of different aspects of geology, and mine, which is concerned with just sort of the skin of the Earth, if you will, is geomorphology.
So somebody hearing about that field, Dr. Alan Howard, would not automatically jump to the conclusion that, oh, here's a guy who's going to be talking about Mars. But as I understand the story, sometime back in the early to mid-1970s,
right.
Somebody at NASA called your boss at the University of Virginia and said something along the lines of, you know, we've got these pictures of Mars from some flybys that were done in the 1960s. We're going to be sending some other spacecraft up to take a look in the near future. And we kind of figure out we need some help reading these pictures. You got anybody who might be able to help us? Is that, in essence, how you got started?
Yeah, that's basically it. Most of the planetary research had been done by the U.S. Geological Survey and just a few other universities, and he was interested in sort of broadening the base of universities that would be doing space research. And, we became interested, and we've looked at a variety of things. How at the present time, Mars is like a desert, so the first thing that I studied...
Well, so back up for me here,
all right.
In terms of how this got started. Your boss apparently said, well, we've got this geomorphologist who's really good, and he studies patterns of geological formations all over Earth. So maybe what we could do is take a look at some of your pictures and see if there are similarities. Is that in essence?
Yeah, that's essentially it. So
for the past 40 years, you've been looking at ever better pictures of Mars and traveling pretty much all around this planet, Earth, looking for similarities?
Yes, that's true. I think the study of planets, other planets, Mars, as well as some satellites of Jupiter and Saturn, has become more and more of the focus of my research over the years, mostly because we're getting such fascinating information coming back from NASA. It's a challenge to take that information, like images that are taken from orbiting spacecraft, and to try to interpret what they mean in terms of what has happened, what the history of that planet or that satellite has been, what kind of processes, whether it's flowing water, whether it's wind, whether it's the evaporation and precipitation of ices, what has created the landscapes that we see.
So tell me some about the places that you've gone here on this planet and found geological formations that cause you and your colleagues to go, aha, this means this must have happened here at this point of time on Earth. And when we look at these really high definition pictures of landscapes on Mars, we see something similar. So we can conclude at one point on Mars, this was happening.
Yes. For example, we see evidence on Mars that at one time there were streams flowing on the surface that had a sinuous or meandering pattern, kind of like the what you see if you look at the lower part of the Mississippi River, where the river doesn't seem to be in any hurry to get anywhere. It wanders around like a snake across the landscape. On Earth, most meandering rivers really require the presence of vegetation on the banks in order for that kind of pattern to occur. But obviously, if we see those on Mars, or not so obviously, I guess, but we can infer that probably we didn't have that kind of vegetation on Mars. We just didn't have enough time that things were amenable for development of complex life on Mars to have developed the kind of trees and shrubs and so on that we see on stream banks. So we were looking at meandering streams on Earth, or looking for meandering streams on Earth in which vegetation on the stream banks was not necessary for their formation. And one place we discovered was way out in Nevada, about 6 miles away from the nearest road. We've done 2 or 3 years worth of study of these very meandering streams and have concluded that it's just a lot of clay, clay-like in your garden, in the stream, allows it to develop this kind of meandering pattern.
Dr. Alan Howard, do I understand correctly that at some point, based on your knowledge of how certain geological formations get created on Earth, that when you look at the landscape in different areas of Mars, you kind of have to say to yourself, these formations on Mars could have only been created if there had been water on this planet?
Yes. You know, it's partly a question of physics. What's capable of, say, carving a stream channel by a flowing fluid? On Earth, it's clearly when we see valleys with channels and streams on the bottom of them, that it's been that water flowing over long periods of time that have created the valley, have created the channel. There are very few fluids that could really do that. On Earth, it's clearly water. On Mars, we think early in its history, it was warm enough that we also had rainfall and water running over the surface, and we can see the former valleys that were created by that.
So if there had been water all those billions of years ago on Mars, then that at least creates the possibility that there was life on Mars.
And that's why we're going there time and time again with a variety of missions to look for evidence of, first of all, habitat that supports life, but then possibly also actually signs of former life.
Well, I want to ask you more about that. Alan Howard from the University of Virginia is our in-studio guest. And when we get back from the break, we have an astronomer who has long been in love with Mars and is teaching other people to love it too. Joining us now by phone is an astronomer who has long been fascinated by the planet Mars. He is a faculty member in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at James Madison University, as well as director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at that university, Chanel Varani. Welcome back to the InSight Airwaves.
Oh, great to be back, Tom.
And Chanel, say hello to Dr. Alan Howard, geomorphologist from the University of Virginia who has long been studying Mars.
Hello, Dr. Howard. A big fan of your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Chanel, I got to tell you that a couple of days ago, I received an email from a colleague who had heard that Dr. Howard was going to be here talking about his work related to similarities between Earth and Mars that he's been doing for so many decades. And she said in her email, and I'm paraphrasing here, I got to tell you, I'm so excited about this because I was just this weekend, I just took my son to the J.C. Wells Planetarium at JMU, and they were talking about Mars, and they were talking about evidence of water on Mars and how that might well mean that there was once life on Mars. And I wrote back to her, and I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, Chanel from that planetarium is going to be with us on Monday. So Thursday. Today's Thursday, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Chanel, what do you want people to know about Mars?
I think, you know, if you were to ask me just generally what's the most outstanding question that in science is just waiting to be answered, as Dr. Howard suggested, it's the discovery of life outside of our planet. It's a question that we've wanted an answer to since the, you know, moment we came out of the cave and looked up. And with the discovery of exoplanets, planets outside of our solar system, we're getting that way. We're finding thousands of planets from the nearby stars. To me, the most exciting place is to answer this question, and perhaps, or to ask this question, and then perhaps to even answer it, is in our solar system, Mars. Some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are the most exciting places that we could possibly send rovers to and ask that question. The last decade of rovers and orbiters that we've sent to Mars, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the Mars Exploration Rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, and now Curiosity, which has landed, you know, inside an ancient riverbed in Gale Crater, is returning evidence that Mars in the past must have had water. It's finding, you know, the kind of features that Dr. Howard's mentioned. It's finding hematite, a mineral that's found in water. So we now know that, you know, definitively, I would say that Mars in the past must have had water. And as Dr. Howard said, you know, the atmosphere of Mars now is about less than 1%, about 0.1% that of Earth's. And so in order for it to have had that liquid water on its surface, it must have had an atmosphere. So you put these two together, that it must have had an atmosphere, that it largely had, it may have had water. And then you look at the terrain, you look at the elevation data, and you find that, you know, much of the northern the northern basin is very smooth. It's at lower elevations than the average Martian surface level, and you start drafting a picture that looks like Earth. As you posted on your Facebook and website, you look at that photograph, you see an ocean, you see an atmosphere, you see cloud cover, and that's, you know, something I'd say in the last decade that we're getting that view. So that to me is the most outstanding thing.
Yeah, and Mars actually is not devoid of water at the present time. It has two polar caps,
right,
with frozen,
right,
water on them, perhaps a mile thick covering of ice on and both of the polar caps, as well as we're finding more and more evidence in terms of small glaciers and things, surface features that suggest that there's still a good bit of water beneath the surface. It's just that it's too cold and the atmosphere is too vacuous to really allow water to flow on the surface of Mars at the present time, except perhaps ephemerally.
So right. To you who are listening, we have here in studio scientist Alan Howard, who approaches studies of Mars from one direction, and scientist Chanel Varani, who approaches it from another direction. We have this direction for you, a phone number. 888-WMRA talk, easy to remember that way, but in all numbers, it's 888-967-2825. Chanel can only be with us for a few minutes, so if you have a question specifically for him, this would be a really good time to call. But I'm curious, based on what you have heard so far, how are you feeling about the question, is there now or has there ever been life on Mars. How important a question do you think that is? Is it a question we should ask about other places in our solar system? Is exploring this question worth spending more money on? 888-WMRA-TALK. Chanel, it seems to me that that question of spending more money for answering these elementary questions about other places in our solar system is something that's kind of a bugaboo for you?
It is. It's something that I get asked a lot, of course, in the planetarium. We also have an economic climate now, of course, that, you know, in our country we have many without jobs, and there's a lot of suffering going on. But we have to put these costs in perspective, I think. You know, if you were to look at the U.S. budget, how much do we spend on NASA? It's half a penny on the dollar. So it's a much tiny amount. Of course, that gets you Hubble, Chandra, Spitzer, all these great space-based telescopes and these rovers that we've been talking about. But if you just look at the rovers we sent to Mars specifically, you know, the Mars Curiosity rover, this SEV-sized rover that's inside a Gale crater right now looking for some of this evidence, that's a $2.5 billion rover. That, of course, is a lot of money. You know, you and I would love to have a million of it. It would change our lives profoundly. But if you were to ask, you know, how much did the London Olympics cost? That was about $15 billion. How much are the Sochi Olympics that are coming up next month going to cost? It's about $25 billion. So it's about a factor of 10 more than what this Curiosity rover is. The Olympic Games last for 2 weeks. This rover is going to be on the planet, hopefully for a decade plus, answering some of these most profound questions.
There are three rovers, Alan Howard, that have been instrumental to your work that have made their way to Mars. There was the Spirit and Opportunity,
right,
and then the latest one that Chanel was just mentioning, Curiosity?
Curiosity, yes. Two of them are still operational. Spirit just had lived a nice, long, productive life, but finally lost its ability to maneuver around on the surface. But when
that only happened about a year ago, didn't it?
Right.
Okay.
And when they were first sent, their life expectancy, or we would have been happy if they'd only lasted a couple of months on the surface. And they've managed to surpass all of our expectations.
In fact,
living.
This month is the 10th anniversary for
right.
those. Yeah.
For Opportunity.
Yes.
For both, Spirit and Opportunity.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They landed within months of each other.
And so is there any one thing that any one of those rovers has established that's been most startling or informative for you, Dr. Howard?
Well, Opportunity, when it landed, found evidence very shortly after it landed of shallow lakes having been present in the area that it was wandering around in. And then, of course, the Curiosity rover actually landed on what's called an alluvial fan. It's like what we see in Death Valley, where streams come down out of the mountains and spread out into low areas. And it actually saw the gravels, the rounded gravels, like in a stream bed that were carried down and deposited on the surface. So it provided the first, absolute proof that water flowed on the surface. We had inferred it from all the landforms we could see, but to see it up close and personal like that put kind of a final stamp of certainty.
So we've only got a couple more minutes with Chanel Varani, the director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium, as well as an astrophysicist from James Madison University. And if you want to talk to him before he goes away, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-967-2825. Dr. Howard is going to continue to be with us here for the rest of the hour. But it'd be good to call him right now, too, 888-WMRA-TALK. Or you can communicate with us through the Virginia Insight Facebook page. We're on Facebook. We're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And, gentlemen, we have this quick comment from Skyler, who says, Earth will look like Mars one day. I don't know if he's serious about that prediction or not, but do you gentlemen have a sense that studying Mars may tell us about the future of Earth?
Do you want to take it, Alan? I can answer.
Yeah, why don't you try?
Yeah. I think that's largely true. You know, Dr. Howard at the beginning of the show, you know, answered the question you asked. Well, you know, how did Mars get to its present state, given the fact that we have this evidence for water and atmosphere in the past? And you know, he pointed out that the magnetic field has died. You know, this magnetic field, as he pointed out, is powered by this molten core, and you can kind of think of it as you know, if you put a potato or one of those ice tray in the fridge, which freezes first? Of course, it's the smaller one. It's each of the individual ice cubes. The potato takes a longer time. Well, Earth is about twice the size of Mars. It's about 10 times as massive. So it takes a longer time for its core to cool down. But once it does, you know, that same process that we think took place on Mars will take place on our planet. The magnetic field will shut down. And the fact that we're twice as close to the sun than Mars is means that the solar radiation, the solar wind that we experience is stronger, and that means it starts decaying, starts deteriorating our atmosphere. So that's true.
You're nodding your head, Alan Howard.
Yes, but there's also, if Earth survives for another 5 billion years,
right,
then the sun's going to get us because the sun has a limited lifetime, and it goes through a period of time where it expands greatly and basically will just chew up all of the planets in our solar system.
But to anyone listening, you're doomed no matter what. This is a long time away.
Chanel Varani is a faculty member in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at James Madison University. He is also director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at that university. Chanel, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for making some time for us.
Not a problem, Tom. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Nice talking to you, Dr. Howard.
Right.
Thank you. Still with us here in the Insight Studio, geomorphologist Alan Howard. He studies how geological landscapes get created here on Earth, and based on interest in his work at NASA that first cropped up in the 1970s, he's also spent much of the past four decades researching similarities between the geology found here on our planet and that found on the planet Mars. If you want to speak with him, our phone number is 888-967-2825. We're going next to Afton. Jim, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please. Hey, Jim, are you there? Oh, I think we lost Jim. Okay. Well, we probably need to clear that line and make it available so anybody else listening can call us at 888-967-2825. We have... joining us now by phone is another astronomer. She's a participating scientist in NASA's Cassini mission to Saturn and Titan. Cassini, of course, is the orbiter that first made its way to Saturn almost 10 years ago. This astronomer is also a research professor at the University of Virginia. Anne Verbischer, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here. Also a fan of Dr. Howard's.
Well, Dr. Verbischer, I know that you've been instrumental in establishing that there is, in fact, water on at least one of the moons of Saturn. And then I want to ask you more about that in a few moments. But let me start with a version of the question we've been asking everyone else. Other than on Earth, of course, is there now or has there ever been life in any other part of our solar system?
Well, we don't quite know the answer to that yet, but I would certainly be surprised if we don't find out that there has been past life at least somewhere in the solar system. And Mars is certainly the top of the list of candidate places to look for past life in the solar system outside of the Earth.
Why? Why would you be surprised if there wasn't?
Well, as you've been talking about, I think because of the evidence of liquid water flowing on the surface is just so overwhelming there, that I think it's highly likely that past life will be found there. Some kind of microbial life. I don't mean little green men running around, but
This is based on the sort of the correlation water equals likelihood of life.
Yes, water being one of the main ingredients for life as we know it. The other things being energy, chemical energy, and there's certainly a lot of that available on the Martian surface as well.
Well, then we're going to have to talk to you pretty soon about the fascinating discoveries you've been making relative to some of the moons of Saturn and the existence of water there. But we have this call coming in from Stanton. I believe this is Mike. Mike, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight.
your question or comment, please, for Ann Verbischer and or Alan Howard.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I was curious about, and this is something I've thought of often in the past, is has anyone mapped or photographed any caverns or cave openings that may allow for easy access for if there are terrestrials or life forms there on Mars to access the surface? Is there any mapping or underground mapping going on that may identify cavernous areas
Alan
on
Howard?
Mars?
Yeah, there's a kind of cave that we're almost certain exists on Mars. Those are what are called lava tube caves. We have some very large, in fact, the largest volcano in our solar system is on Mars. And we've seen holes in the ground that look like lava tubes that have collapsed. Now, they're not like the caves that we see, say, in the Shenandoah Valley here that are formed in limestone that have been dissolved by water flowing through them. But nonetheless, even lava tube caves very often have abundant life having developing and persisting in them because they're sheltered environments. They're often wet if there's water around. So there have been suggestions that there are soluble rocks that can dissolve on Mars as well, but we don't have definitive evidence for that.
Mike, that's such a terrific question that I never would have thought to ask. So I'm curious, what made you think of caves?
Well, it just strikes me as a unique, uniquely specific area to search for, because on Earth, you know, we have the caves are an underground, out of sight area, but an interesting place to check anyway. Thank you for my call.
Thanks, Mike. Dr. Alan Howard, geomorphologist. One of the things that you do in your research around this planet is look for unusual ways that water creates geological formation?
Yes.
And some of that's been in New Zealand?
New Zealand, yeah. We see in Mars on some very young, steep, what they call gullies. They're more or less just linear, deep incisions on the walls of some craters on Mars that are very young. And there's been a debate going on about whether water is required to form them. What do I mean by very young? Well, within the last few million years. But it's if that were the case and water is involved in forming of these, then it implies, lots about the surface of Mars at the present time, that in fact we have water that can still occasionally flow on the surface.
So speaking about water.
Yeah.
Our astronomer on the phone line with us here, Ann Verbischer, has been instrumental in the discovery of what looks a heck of a lot like water on a little tiny moon of Saturn. So we're going to ask her about that when we continue here on Virginia Insight in a bit more than 1 minute, and remind you that if you've got any kinds of questions, comments, thoughts, insights to share, either about Mars or anything else going out there on in space, we've got a phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Research professor at the University of Virginia, Ann Verbischer, is with us by phone. She's also a participating scientist in NASA's Cassini mission to Saturn and Titan. Here with us in studio, Alan Howard, professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia, who for some 40 years now has been studying similarities between geological patterns here on Earth and those on the planet Mars. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. You can reach us either on Facebook, if you've got a question or comment, you can post to us on Facebook. We're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. By phone, the number is easy to remember, is 888-WMRA-TALK. Ann Verbischer, I got to tell you, one of my colleagues earlier today congratulated me on pronouncing the name of this tiny moon of Saturn correctly, which I took as meaning he's a total science geek, because before I had talked to you, I'd never heard of Enceladus before. I don't know how many people listening have. Tell us about it.
Well, Enceladus is one of the moons of Saturn, and for a long time, it was really just known as a moon of Saturn, and not really much more interesting than that, other than its location close to Saturn is inside of a very tenuous, dusty ring, one of the outer rings of Saturn, not the main ones that you see when you look through a telescope. And its position within that ring was always puzzling. And the Cassini spacecraft that has been mentioned previously, that has been exploring the Saturn system for almost 10 years now, took some interesting pictures early on of that moon at a very unique geometry, almost put looking back at the sun. So you're seeing the moon as a very, very thin crescent, if you were to see any part of the surface at all lit by the sun. But what the Cassini camera showed was that coming out of the South Pole was a tremendous amount of particles. And they were all forward scattering light, like dust does on your windshield. If your windshield on your car is dirty and you're driving into the sunset or sunrise in the morning and you can't see, you get blinded by these things. And that's just what's happening with the light that's being scattered off of these particles coming out of the south pole of Enceladus. And what this turns out to be is water, a tremendous amount of water that is being erupted from the south pole of this tiny little moon, which is about the size of the state of Arizona across. It's only about 300 miles across. So it's quite remarkable that this little world has obviously liquid water just below its surface. The real question is just how far below the surface. Is it really close or is it really, really deep inside? But that's just been a fascinating and certainly highlight of the Cassini mission, is the discovery of this active world in the Saturn system.
Yeah, it's more amazing because the temperatures in general out at that part of our solar system are so low, on the order of, we call it 100 degrees Kelvin, but that's what minus...
I think it's around minus 300 Fahrenheit, something
right,
like that.
Right, minus 300 Fahrenheit, yeah.
Can life exist at those temperatures? Do we know?
Well, not at minus 300 Fahrenheit, but somehow that minus 300 Fahrenheit ice is getting warmed up, and getting warmed up to enough to the point that it melts. So it's getting up to the melting temperature of water.
There must be something going on below the surface?
Right, right.
And
something
is possible
going on below the surface to generate heat.
So it's possible you've got liquid water below the surface. That means it's possible there's life there?
Well, that's one of the main ingredients. It's hard to say whether there's life there or not. The life could be part of what's generating that heat. We just don't know what lies below the surface of Enceladus. It'd be fascinating to go back there and try and explore what's below the surface of Enceladus. There is another moon of in the solar system. Jupiter's moon Europa is much, much larger than Enceladus and also has a subsurface liquid water ocean. And that's really been the focus of future exploration of the outer solar system in terms of in hopes of looking for either current or past life. And that's certainly one of the top targets, or Europa's a top target for looking for life in the solar system.
Europa,
subsurface ocean there.
Europa and Verbischer is, as you say, a moon, a satellite of the planet Jupiter?
Yes.
And if I recall, Anne, what you've told me in the past, it's been established that Europa, which is a little bigger than the planet Mercury, right?
No, Europa is not quite as big as Mercury. Titan was Saturn's moon.
Okay. That's
bigger than Mercury.
So Europa is significantly smaller than Earth.
Yes, it's smaller than Earth, yes.
But it's thought to actually have more water than Earth has on it today?
That's been the calculation, yes, that if you take all the water on Earth, all of our oceans, rivers, lakes, everything, and put it in one giant sphere hanging out in space and compare it to the amount of water that's on Europa, Europa would win that contest.
Alan, unfortunately, it's hidden underneath a thick layer of ice, so we can't actually see the water. But the reason we think that life might have developed there is that there's the chemical energy. All life not only needs water, but it needs chemical energy. And there's almost certainly heat that's generated in the interior from the same kind of radioactive decay of elements that creates the heat inside our Earth. And that energy could potentially have provided a stable environment that would have been present for billions of years that would allow life to have developed. It would not be the kind of life that we know now, like algae and plants and so on, that require the sun's illumination for their life processes. But it would be a life that would depend upon chemicals that you would find, say, for example, in our ocean, deep on the floor of the ocean, where we, for example, have what are called hydrothermal vents, where deep waters laden with chemicals come up into our ocean, and there's a multiplicity of life that is able to develop and flourish under those circumstances on Earth. So we draw the analogy that perhaps that could have happened on Europa.
Ann Verbischer, you are only going to be with us for a couple more minutes. So before you go away, I want to ask you a particularly unfair question.
Okay.
Now, I know that Alan Howard, as a geomorphologist, has been researching similarities between our planet Earth and Mars since the early 1970s. You, as an astronomer, have been focusing on different aspects of our solar system since the mid to late 1980s. So here's my unfair question. Out of all of those years of research that you've been doing, what's the one thing you most want people to know or to think about before you leave us today?
Oh, let's see. I would just advise not to be, not to rule anything out, you know, to be open to all possibilities that any planetary exploration we've done, any exploration of the solar system that we've done, all these space probes that we've sent out to the various planets, giant planets, outer regions of the solar system, we have always been surprised by what we find. Every single time, the pictures returned back, the data we get, always throw us for a loop somewhere. We're always finding out something new. So I guess that would be my
And I guess that's part of why you love being in this field is because you love those surprises.
Sure. The exploration is really motivating, definitely motivating and exciting to be a part of.
Participating scientist in NASA's Cassini mission to Saturn and Titan, as well as a research professor in the Department of Astronomy at the University of Virginia. Ann Verbischer, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
So, geologist, geomorphologist, and professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia, Alan Howard. We talked a little bit earlier about how not only is study of Earth and looking for similarities to Mars informing us on what's been going on with Mars over hundreds of millions, if not billions of years, but it may also be informing us a little bit about what's going on Earth. I understand that in one area of research, you've actually traveled to a part of South America that is thought to be the most arid place on Earth.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and what you learned.
The northern part of Chile and the southern part of Peru, it's called the Atacama Desert. It's close to the west coast of South America. And because the ocean is very cold in that that location, we get almost no rainfall. You know, our rainfall that we have on Earth largely derives from water evaporated from the oceans. And when the oceans are cold, you get relatively little evaporation. So there's only a few millimeters of rainfall a year in this desert, in parts of it anyway. And there are some, you still occasionally get large amounts of rainfall occurring. And so this is kind of an interesting analog because that particularly toward the end of rivers flowing on Mars and channels being created, we probably had an environment that was pretty much like that, very, very dry with just occasional water flowing over the surface. So we see some types of landforms that we call alluvial fans in that environment that look a lot like some in terms of their visual appearance and their properties that we see on Mars.
Does it tell us anything about something that it would be good to understand relative to what goes on in the ecology of this Earth?
Mm-hmm. Well, these particular, well, I guess there's a general answer and a specific answer. With regard to these fans, they're somewhat unusual on Earth, but probably not as unusual as one might expect. The oil is something that we're always looking for in sediments because it's the remains of organic material and the like. And understanding how these deposits of sediment are laid down is kind of an important topic of study from an economic standpoint. But these particular fans are probably not that directly related to anything of economic importance on Earth, other than the fact that you have these occasional really strong flows that could, if people actually wanted to live there, which they don't very much, would be dangerous to people. But from the larger standpoint, I think the exploration of other planets and looking for analogs to those on Earth is kind of cross-fertilizing. We learn more about what is going on those planets or those satellites. On Titan, for example, we have rivers of methane that have excavated valleys. And so we can see that it doesn't necessarily have to be water that creates river valleys, that under the right circumstances, a totally different fluid that we see on Titan, which is methane, can do the same kind of thing. So there's an analog there that's indirect, but nonetheless tells us a lot about how the universe works, basically.
As I've mentioned a couple of times, you have spent some 40 years traveling this globe,
mm-hmm.
looking for evidence and finding it of similarities to formations on Earth and formations on Mars. It's my understanding that you got into this field of research that you love, geomorphology, mm-hmm. in part because of vacations that your family used to take back in the 1950s. So for the sake of all of us who've ever been piled into a station wagon as a kid or parents who have their kids howling in the back on a family vacation, before we close out today, tell us about the significance of those family vacations.
Yes, well, we would pile in the car. We would drive for 2 or 3 days to get out into the western part of the United States, and we went to the Black Hills, we went to Yellowstone, we went to the Tetons. And up to that point, I really hadn't realized how much I was attracted to those kinds of mountainous and colorful landscapes, and very sharply edged landscapes that you see out in the western part of the United States. And it just sort of kindled an interest that grew through time. Originally, I thought I was going to be a physics major when I went to college, and I took a geology course just to sort of see what it was all about, and it became so interesting to me that I changed my field of interest into geology to try to understand how the processes that form the Earth actually occur. So it was, you know, everybody has something, I think, that you don't understand at the time is going to, it informs what your decision about how you conduct your life is going to be. And for me, it was those trips where I saw these incredible forms of nature that you find in mountains, in hot springs, in the landscapes of the Black Hills and so on, that just intrigued me.
Well, I think we're all grateful that your parents took you on those trips all those years ago, because we got to spend this fascinating time with you that maybe we wouldn't have otherwise. Our guest has been Alan Howard, professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia and a geomorphologist who for some four decades now has been studying similarities between geological formations here on Earth and those on the planet Mars. Alan, thank you so very much for making time.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed myself greatly.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Dan Easley, Terry Ward, and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find postings of Virginia Insight on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you'll find links to more information about Dr. Howard and the work he is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.